Doomsday Book, Cassette 9.
There were four other directors, all similar in tone, and a note from William Gadsden with a printout of Badri's credit account for Monday, the 20th of December, attached. Badri had apparently spent that missing time from noon to 2:30 Christmas shopping. He had purchased four books, paperback, at Blackwell's, a muffler, red, and a digital carillon miniature at Debenhams. Wonderful. That meant dozens and dozens more contacts. Colin came in carrying a napkin full of muffins. He was still wearing his paper crown, which was a good deal the worse for the rain. "It would reassure everyone, sir," Finch said, "if after your call comes through, you'd come over to Hall. Mrs. Gadsden particularly is convinced you've come down with the virus. She said you'd contracted it through poor ventilation in the dormitories."
"I'll put in an appearance," Dunworthy promised.
Finch went to the door and then turned back. "About Mrs. Gadsden, sir. She's behaving dreadfully, criticizing the college and demanding that she be moved in with her son. She's completely undermining morale."
"I'll say," Colin said, dumping the muffins on the table. "The gallstone told me hot breads were bad for my immune system."
"Isn't there some sort of volunteer work she could do at infirmary or something?" Finch asked. "To keep her out of college?"
"We can hardly inflict her on poor, helpless flu victims. We might kill them. What about asking the vicar? He was looking for volunteers to run errands."
"The vicar?" Colin said. "Have a heart, Mr. Dunworthy. I'm working for the vicar."
"The priest from Holy Reform, then," Dunworthy said. "He's fond of reciting the mass in time of pestilence for morale. They should get along swimmingly."
"I'll phone him straight away," Finch said, and left. Dunworthy ate his breakfast, except for the muffin, which Colin appropriated, and then took the empty tray over to Hall, leaving orders for Colin to come get him immediately if the tech rang up. It was still raining, the trees black and dripping, and the Christmas tree lights spotted with rain. Everyone was still at table, except for the bell ringers who stood off to one side in their white gloves, their handbells on the table in front of them. Finch was demonstrating the wearing of the NHS regulation masks, pulling off the tapes at either side and pressing them to his cheeks.
"You don't look well at all, Mr. Dunworthy," Mrs. Gadsden said. "And no wonder. The conditions in this college are appalling. It's a wonder to me that there has not been an epidemic before this. Poor ventilation and an extremely uncooperative staff. Your Mr. Finch was quite rude to me when I spoke to him about moving into my son's rooms. He told me I had chosen to be in Oxford during a quarantine and that I had to take whatever accommodations I was given."
Colin came skidding in.
"There's someone on the telephone for you," he said.
Dunworthy started past her, but she placed herself solidly in his way.
"I told Mr. Finch that he might be content to stay at home when his son was in danger, but that I was not."
"I'm afraid I'm wanted on the telephone," Dunworthy said.
"I told him no real mother could fail to go when her child was alone and ill in a faraway place."
"Mr. Dunworthy," Colin said, "come along."
"Of course, you clearly have no idea what I'm talking about. Look at this child." She grabbed Colin by the arm, "running about in the pouring rain with no coat on."
Dunworthy took advantage of her shift in position to get past her.
"You obviously care nothing about your boys catching the Indian flu," she said.
Colin wrenched free, letting him gorge himself on muffins and go about soaked to the skin. Dunworthy sprinted across the quad,
Colin at his heels. I shall not be surprised if this virus turns out to have originated here in Balliol, Mrs. Gadsden shouted after them. Sheer negligence, that's what it is. Sheer negligence. Dunworthy burst into the room and snatched up the phone. There was no picture. Andrews, he shouted. Are you there? I can't see you.
The telephone system's overbooked, Montoya said. They've cut the visual. It's Lupe Montoya. Is Mr. Basingham salmon or trout?
What?
Dunworthy said, frowning at the blank screen. I've been calling fishing guides in Scotland all morning when I could get through. They say where he's gone depends on whether he's salmon or trout. What about friends? Is there someone in the university he goes fishing with who might know?
I don't know, Dunworthy said. Miss Montoya, I'm afraid I'm waiting for a most important...
I've tried everything else. Hotels, inns, boat rentals, even his barber. I tracked his wife down in Torquay, and she said he didn't tell her where he was going. I hope that doesn't mean he's off somewhere with a woman, and not really in Scotland at all.
I hardly think, Mr. Basingham.
Yes, well, then why doesn't anyone know where he is? And why hasn't he called in now that the epidemic's all over the papers and the vids?
Miss Montoya, I
suppose I'll have to call both the salmon and trout guides. I'll let you know if I find him. She rang off finally, and Dunworthy put the receiver down and stared at it. Certain Andrews had tried to ring while he was on the line with Montoya.
Didn't you say there were a lot of epidemics in the Middle Ages? Colin asked.
He was sitting in the window seat with the Middle Ages book on his knees, eating muffins.
Yes.
Well, I can't find them in this book. How'd you spell it?
Try Black Death,
Dunworthy said. Dunworthy waited an anxious quarter of an hour and then tried to ring Andrews again. The lines were still jammed.
Did you know the Black Death was in Oxford?
Colin said. He had polished off the muffins and was back to the soap tablets.
At Christmas, just like us.
Influenza scarcely compares with the plague, he said,
watching the telephone as if he could will it to ring.
The Black Death killed one-third to one-half of Europe.
I know, Colin said. And the plague was a lot more interesting. It was spread by rats, and you got these enormous bobos.
Buboes.
Buboes, under your arms, and they turned black and swelled up till they were enormous, and then you died.
The flu doesn't have anything like that, he said, sounding disappointed.
No.
And the flu's only one disease. There were three sorts of plague. Bubonic, that's the one with the buboes. Pneumonic, he said, pronouncing the P. It went in your lungs and you coughed up blood. And septicemic, which went into your bloodstream and killed you in 3 hours. And your body turned black all over. Isn't that apocalyptic?
Yes,
Dunworthy said. The telephone rang just after 11 o'clock, and Dunworthy snatched it up again. But it was Mary, saying she wouldn't be able to manage dinner.
We've had 5 new cases this morning. We'll come to infirmary as soon as my trunk call has come through,
Dunworthy promised.
I'm waiting for one of my techs to phone. I'm going to have him come and read the fix.
Mary looked wary.
Have you cleared this with Gilchrist? Gilchrist? He's busy planning to send Kivrin to the Black Death.
Nevertheless, I don't think you should do this without telling him. He is acting head, and there's no point in antagonizing him.
If something has gone wrong and Andrews needs to abort the drop, you'll need his cooperation. She smiles at Dunworthy. We'll discuss it when you come. And when you're here, I want you to have an inoculation.
I thought you were waiting for the analog.
I was. But I'm not satisfied with the way the primary cases are responding to Atlanta's recommended course of treatment. A few of them are showing a slight improvement. But Badri is worse, if anything. I want all high-risk people to have T-cell enhancement. Andrew still hadn't phoned by noon. Dunworthy sent Colin over to infirmary to be inoculated. He came back looking pained.
As bad as all that?
Dunworthy asked. Worst, Colin said, flinging himself down on the window seat. Mrs. Gadsden caught me coming in. I was rubbing my arm, and she demanded to know where I'd been and why I was getting inoculated instead of William. He looked reproachfully at Dunworthy. Well, it hurts. She said if anyone was high risk, it was poor Willie, and it was absolute necrophilia for me to be jabbed instead of him.
Nepotism.
Nepotism. I hope the priest finds her an absolutely cadaverous job.
How was your great-aunt Mary?
I didn't see her. They were awfully busy, beds in the corridor and everything. Colin and Dunworthy took turns going over to Hall for Christmas dinner. Colin was back in something less than 15 minutes. The bell ringer started to play, he said. Mr. Finch said to tell you we're out of sugar and butter and nearly out of cream. He pulled a jelly tart out of his jacket pocket. Why is it they never run out of Brussels sprouts? Dunworthy gave him orders to come tell him at once if Andrews phoned, and to take down any other messages, and went over. The bell ringers were in full cry, jangling away at a Mozart cannon. Finch handed Dunworthy a plate that seemed to be mostly Brussels sprouts. We're nearly out of turkey, I'm afraid, sir, he said. I'm glad you've come. It's almost time for the Queen's Christmas message. The bell ringers finished the Mozart to enthusiastic applause, and Miss Taylor came over still wearing her white gloves. There you are, Mr. Dunworthy, she said. I missed you at breakfast, and Mr. Finch said you were the one to talk to. We need a practice room. He was tempted to say, I'd no idea you practiced. He ate a Brussels sprout.
A practice room?
Yes. So we can practice our Chicago surprise minor. I've arranged with the Dean of Christ Church to ring our peal here on New Year's Day. But we have to have somewhere to practice. I told Mr. Finch the big room in Beard would be perfect.
The senior common room?
But Mr. Finch said it was being used as a storeroom for supplies.
What supplies? He thought. According to Finch, they were either out or nearly out of everything, save Brussels sprouts.
And he said the lecture rooms were being kept to use as an infirmary. We have to have a quiet place where we can focus. The Chicago surprise minor is very complicated. The in and out of course changes and the lead end alterations require complete concentration. And, of course, there's the extra dodging.
Of course, Dunworthy said.
The room doesn't have to be large, but it does need to be secluded. We've been practicing here in the dining room, but there are people in and out all the time, and the tenor keeps losing her place.
I'm sure we can find something.
Of course, with 7 bells, we should be doing triples. But the North American Council rang Philadelphia triples here last year and did a very sloppy job of it, too, as I understand.
the tenor a full count behind an absolutely terrible stroking, which is another reason we've got to have a good practice room. Stroking is so important.
Of course,
Dunworthy said. Mrs. Gadsden appeared in the far doorway, looking fierce and maternal.
I'm afraid I have an important trunk call coming in, he said,
standing up so that Miss Taylor was between him and Mrs. Gadsden. Trunk call? Miss Taylor said, shaking her head. You English.
I don't understand what you're saying half the time.
Dunworthy escaped out the buttery door, promising to find a practice room so that they could perfect their snapping leads, and went back up to his rooms. Andrews hadn't phoned. There was one message from Montoya.
She said to tell you never mind, Colin said.
That's all? She didn't say anything else?
Nope, she said. Tell Mr. Dunworthy, never mind.
He wondered if she had by some miracle located Basingham and obtained his signature, or if she had merely found out whether he was salmon or trout. He debated ringing her back, but he was afraid the lines would choose that moment to unjam and Andrews would phone. He didn't, or they didn't, until nearly 4.
I'm terribly sorry I didn't ring you sooner, Andrews said.
There was still no picture, but Dunworthy could hear music and talk in the background.
I was away till last night, and I've had a good deal of trouble getting through to you, Andrews said. The lines have been engaged, holiday crush, you know. I've been trying every...
I need you to come up to Oxford,
Dunworthy cut in.
I need you to read a fix.
Of course, sir, Andrews said promptly.
When? Soon as possible. This evening.
Oh, he said, less promptly.
Would tomorrow do? My living won't get in till late tonight, so we'd planned on having our Christmas tomorrow, but I could get a train up in the afternoon or evening. Will that do? Or is there a limit on taking the fix? The fix is already taken. The text come down with a virus and I need someone to read it,
Dunworthy said. There was a sudden burst of laughter from Andrew's end. Dunworthy raised his voice.
What time do you think you can be here?
I'm not certain.
Can I ring you back tomorrow and tell you when I'll be coming in on the tube?
Yes. But you can only take the tube as far as Barton. You'll need to take a taxi from there to the perimeter. I'll arrange for you to be let through. All right, Andrews?
He didn't answer, though Dunworthy could still hear the music.
Andrews?
Dunworthy said.
Are you still there?
It was maddening not to be able to see.
Yes, sir,
Andrews said, but warily.
What was it you said you wanted me to do?
Read a fix.
It's already been taken, but the tech...
No. The other bit. About taking the train to Barton.
Take the train to Barton,
Dunworthy said loudly and carefully.
That's as far as it goes. From there... You'll have to get a taxi to the quarantine perimeter.
Quarantine?
Yes,
Dunworthy said, irritated.
I'll arrange for you to be allowed into the quarantine area.
What sort of quarantine?
A virus, he said. You haven't heard about it?
No, sir. I was running an on-site in Florence. I only arrived back this afternoon.
Is it serious?
He did not sound frightened, only interested.
81 cases so far,
Dunworthy said. 82, Colin said from the window seat.
But they've identified it, and the vaccine's on the way. There haven't been any fatalities. But a lot of unhappy people who wanted to be home for Christmas, I'll wager, he said. I'll call you in the morning, then, as soon as I know what time I'll arrive. Yes, Dunworthy shouted to make sure Andrews could hear over the background noise. I'll be here. Right, Andrews said. There was another burst of laughter and then silence as he rang off. Is he coming? Colin asked. Yes, tomorrow. He punched in Gilchrist's number. Gilchrist appeared, sitting at his desk and looking belligerent. Mr. Dunworthy, if this is about pulling Miss Engel out... I would if I could, Dunworthy thought, and wondered if Gilchrist truly didn't realize Kivrin had already left the drop site and wouldn't be there if they did open the net. No, he said. I've located a tech who can come read the fix. Mr. Dunworthy, may I remind you, I am fully aware that you are in charge of this drop, Dunworthy said, trying to keep his temper. I was merely trying to help. Knowing the difficulty of finding techs over VAC, I telephoned one in Reading. He can be here tomorrow. Gilchrist pursed his lips disapprovingly. None of this would be necessary if your tech hadn't fallen ill. But as he has, I suppose this will have to do. Have him report to me as soon as he arrives. Dunworthy managed to say goodbye civilly, but as soon as the screen went blank, he slammed the receiver down, yanked it up again, and began stabbing numbers. He would find Basingham if it took all afternoon. But the computer came on and informed him all lines were engaged again. He laid the receiver down and stared at the blank screen. Are you waiting for another call? Colin asked. No. Then can we walk over to infirmary? I have a present for Great Aunt Mary. And I can see about getting Andrews into the quarantine area, he thought. Excellent idea. You can wear your new muffler. Colin stuffed it into his jacket pocket. I'll put it on when we get there, he said, grinning. I don't want anyone to see me on the way. There was no one to see them. The streets were completely deserted, not even any bicycles or taxis. Dunworthy thought of the vicar's remark that when the epidemic took hold, people would hole up in their houses. Either that, or they had been driven inside by the sound of the Carfax carillon, which was not only still banging away at the carol of the bells, but seemed louder, echoing through the empty streets. Or they were napping after too much Christmas dinner. Or they knew enough to keep in out of the rain. They saw no one at all until they got to infirmary. A woman in a Burberry stood in front of the casualties ward holding a picket sign that said, Ban Foreign Diseases. A man wearing a regulation face mask opened the door for them and handed Dunworthy a very damp flyer. Dunworthy asked at the admissions desk for Mary and then read the flyer. In bold-faced type it said, Fight Influenza. Vote to secede from the EC. Underneath was a paragraph. Why will you be separated from your loved ones this Christmas? Why are you forced to stay in Oxford? Why are you in danger of getting ill and dying? Because the EC allows infected foreigners to enter England, and England doesn't have a thing to say about it. An Indian immigrant carrying a deadly virus. Dunworthy didn't read the rest. He turned it over. It read, A vote for secession is a vote for health. Committee for an independent Great Britain. Mary came in, and Colin grabbed his muffler out of his pocket and wrapped it hastily around his neck.
Happy Christmas, he said. Thank you for the muffler. Shall I open your cracker for you?
Yes, please, Mary said. She looked tired. She was wearing the same lab coat she had had on 2 days ago. Someone had pinned a cluster of holly to the lapel. Colin snapped the cracker.
Put your hat on, he said, unfolding a blue paper crown.
Have you managed to get any rest at all? Dunworthy asked.
A bit, she said, putting the crown on over her untidy grey hair. We've had 30 new cases since noon, and I spent most of the day trying to get the sequencing from the WIC, but the lines are jammed.
I know, Dunworthy said. Can I see Badri?
Only for a minute or two, she frowned.
He's not responding at all to the synthamycin, and neither are the two students from the dance in Headington. Beverly Breen is a bit improved. She frowned.
It worries me.
Have you had your enhancement?
Not yet. Colin's had his.
And it hurt like blood, Colin said, unfolding the slip of paper inside the cracker. Shall I read your motto for you? She nodded.
I need to bring a tech into the quarantine area tomorrow to read Kivrin's fix, Dunworthy said. What must I do to arrange it?
Nothing, so far as I know. They're trying to keep people in, not out.
The registrar took Mary aside and spoke softly and urgently to her. I must go, she said. I don't want you to leave till you've had your enhancement. Come back down here when you've seen Badri. Colin, you wait here for Mr. Dunworthy.
Dunworthy went up to isolation.
There was no one at the desk, so he wrestled his way into a set of SPGs, remembering to put the gloves on last, and went inside.
The pretty nurse who had been so interested in William was taking Badri's pulse, her eyes on the screens. Dunworthy stopped at the foot of the bed.
Mary had said Badri wasn't responding, but Dunworthy was still shocked by the sight of him.
His face was dark with fever again, and his eyes looked bruised, as if someone had hit him. His right arm was hooked to an elaborate shunt. It was bruised a purple-blue on the inside of the elbow. The other arm was worse, black all along the forearm.
Badri,
he said, and the nurse shook her head.
You can only stay a moment, she said.
Dunworthy nodded. She laid Badri's unresisting hand down at his side, typed something on the console, and went out.
Dunworthy sat down beside the bed and looked up at the screens. They looked the same, still indecipherable, the graphs and jags and generating numbers telling him nothing.
He looked at Badri, who lay there looking battered, beaten. He patted his hand gently and stood up to go.
It was the rats, Badri murmured.
Badri, Dunworthy said gently. It's Mr. Dunworthy.
Mr. Dunworthy,
Badri said. But he didn't open his eyes.
I'm dying, aren't I?
He felt a twinge of fear.
No, of course not, he said heartily. Where'd you get that idea?
It's always fatal,
Badri said.
What is?
Badri didn't answer. Dunworthy sat with him until the nurse came in, but he didn't say anything else. Mr. Dunworthy, she said, he needs to rest.
I know.
He walked to the door and then looked back at Badri lying in the bed. He opened the door.
It killed them all, Badri said. Half of Europe.
Colin was standing at the registrar's desk when he came back down, telling her about his Christmas gift. My mother's gift didn't arrive because of the quarantine. The postman wouldn't let them through. Dunworthy told the registrar about the T-cell enhancement, and she nodded and said, "It will just be a moment." They sat down to wait. It killed them all, Dunworthy thought. Half of Europe. I didn't get to read her motto, Colin said. Would you like to hear it? He didn't wait for an answer. Where was Father Christmas when the lights went out? He waited expectantly. Dunworthy shook his head. In the dark. He took his gobstopper out of his pocket, unwrapped it, and stuck it in his mouth. You're worried about your girl, aren't you?
Yes.
He folded up the gobstopper wrapper into a tiny packet. What I don't understand is, why can't you go get her?
She isn't there. We must wait for the rendezvous.
No. I mean, why can't you go back to the same time you sent her through and get her while she was still there, before anything happened? I mean, you can go to any time you want, can't you?
No, he said. You can send an historian to any time, but once she's there, the net can only operate in real time. Did you study the paradoxes at school?
Yes, Colin said, but he sounded uncertain. They're like time travel rules.
The space-time continuum doesn't allow paradoxes,
Dunworthy said.
It would be a paradox if Kivrin made something happen that hadn't happened, or if she caused an anachronism.
Colin was still looking uncertain.
One of the paradoxes is that no one can be in two places at the same time. She's already been in the past for 4 days. There's nothing we can do to change that. It's already happened.
Then how does she get back?
When she went through, the tech took what's called a fix. It tells the tech exactly where she is, and it acts as,
He groped for an understandable word.
A tether. It ties the two times together so the net can be reopened at a certain time and she can be picked up.
Like, I'll meet you at the church at 6:30?
Exactly. Called a rendezvous. Kivrin's is in 2 weeks, the 28th of December. On that day, the tech will open the net and Kivrin will come back through.
I thought you said it was the same time there. How can the 28th be 2 weeks from now?
They used a different calendar in the Middle Ages. It's December the 17th there. Our rendezvous date is the 6th of January. If she's there. If I can find a tech to open the net.
Colin pulled out his gobstopper and looked at it thoughtfully. It was a mottled bluish-white and looked rather like a map of the moon. He stuck it back in his mouth. So, if I went to 1320 on the 26th of December, I could have Christmas twice.
Yes, I suppose so.
Apocalyptic, he said. He unfolded the gobstopper wrapper and folded it into an even tinier packet. I think they've forgotten about you, don't you?
Beginning to look that way,
Dunworthy said. The next time a house officer came through, Dunworthy stopped him and told him he was waiting for T-cell enhancement.
Oh,
he said, looking surprised.
I'll try to find out about it.
He disappeared into casualties. They waited some more. It was the rat. Badri had said. And that first night he had asked Dunworthy, what year is it? But he had said there was minimal slippage. He had said the apprentice's calculations were correct. Colin took his gobstopper out and examined it several times for change in colour. If something terrible happened, couldn't you break the rules? He said, squinting at it. If she got her arm cut off, or she died, or a bomb blew her up or something.
They're not rules, Colin. They're scientific laws. We couldn't break them if we tried. If we attempted to reverse events that had already happened, the net wouldn't open.
Colin spit his gobstopper into the wrapper and folded the wrinkled paper carefully around it. I'm sure your girl's all right, he said. He jammed the wrapped gobstopper in his jacket pocket and pulled out a lumpy parcel. I forgot to give Great Aunt Mary her Christmas present, he said. He jumped up and started into casualties before Dunworthy could caution him to wait, got opposite the door, and came tearing back. Blood! The gallstone's here, he said. She's coming this way. Dunworthy stood up.
That's all that's needed.
This way, Colin said. I came in the back door the night I got here. He sprinted off in the other direction. Come on! Dunworthy couldn't manage a sprint, but he walked quickly down the labyrinth of corridors Colin indicated and out a service entrance into a side street. A man in a sandwich board was standing outside the door in the rain. The sandwich board said, "The doom we feared is upon us," which seemed oddly fitting. I'll make certain she didn't see us, Colin said, and dashed around to the front. The man handed Dunworthy a flyer. The end of time is near, it said, in fiery capital letters. Fear God, for the hour of his judgment is come. Revelations, chapter 14, verse 7. Colin waved to Dunworthy from the corner. It's all right, Colin said, slightly out of breath. She's inside, shouting at the registrar. Dunworthy handed the flyer back to the man and followed Colin. He led the way along the side street to Woodstock Road. Dunworthy looked anxiously toward the door of casualties, but he couldn't see anyone, not even the anti-EC picketers. Colin sprinted another block and then slowed to a walk. He pulled the packet of soap tablets out of his pocket and offered Dunworthy one. He declined. Colin popped a pink one in his mouth and said, none too clearly, "This is the best Christmas I've ever had." Dunworthy pondered that sentiment for several blocks. The carillon was massacring in the bleak midwinter, which also seemed fitting, and the streets were still deserted. But as they turned down the broad, a familiar figure hurried toward them, hunched against the rain. It's Mr. Finch, Colin said.
Good Lord, Dunworthy said. What do you suppose we've run out of now?
I hope it's Brussels sprouts. Finch had looked up at the sound of their voices. There you are, Mr. Dunworthy, thank goodness. I've been looking for you everywhere.
What is it?
Dunworthy said.
I told Miss Taylor I'd see about a practice room.
It isn't that, sir. It's the detainees. Two of them are down with the virus.
Transcript from the Doomsday Book. 21st of December, 1320. Old style. Father Roche doesn't know where the drop is. I made him take me to the place where Darwin met him. But even standing in the clearing didn't jog my memory. It's obvious Darwin didn't happen upon him until he was a long way from the drop, and by that time I was completely delirious. And I realize today, I'll never be able to find the drop on my own. The woods are too big, and they're full of clearings and oak trees and willow thickets that all look alike now that it's snowed. I should have marked the drop with something besides the casket. Darwin will have to show me where the drop is, And he's not back yet.
Rosamond told me it's only a half day's ride to Courcy, but that he will probably spend the night there because of the rain. It's been raining hard since we got back, and I suppose I should be happy since it may melt the snow. But it makes it impossible for me to go out and look for the drop. And it's freezing in the manor house. Everyone's wearing their cloaks and huddling next to the fire. What do the villagers do? Their huts can't even keep the wind out, and the one I was in had no sign of a blanket. They must be literally freezing. And Rosamond said the steward said it was going to rain till Christmas Eve. Rosamond apologized for her ill-tempered behavior in the woods and told me I was wroth with my sister. Agnes had nothing to do with it. What upset her was obviously the news that her fiancé had been invited for Christmas. And when I had a chance with Rosamond alone, I asked her if she was worried over her marriage. "My father has arranged it," she said, threading her needle. "We were betrothed at Martinmas. We are to be wed at Easter." "And it is with your consent?" I asked. "It is a good match," she said. "Sir Blowett is highly placed, and he has holdings that adjoin my father's." "Do you like him?" She stabbed the needle into the linen in the wooden frame. "My father would never let me come to harm," she said, and pulled the long thread through. She didn't volunteer anything else. And all I could get out of Agnes was that Sir Blowett was nice and had brought her a silver penny, no doubt as part of the betrothal gift. Agnes was too concerned about her knee to tell me anything else. She stopped complaining about it halfway home, and then limped exaggeratedly when she got down off the sorrel. I thought she was just trying to get attention, but when I looked at it, the scab had come off completely. The area around it is red and swollen. I washed it off, wrapped it in as clean a cloth as I could find. I'm afraid it may have been one of Hermione's coifs. I found it in the chest at the foot of the bed, and made her sit quietly by the fire and play with her knight. But I'm worried. If it gets infected, it could be serious. There weren't any antimicrobials in the 1300s. Eloise is worried too. She clearly expected Garwin back tonight, and has been going to stand by the screens all day, looking out the door. I have not been able to figure out how she feels about Garwin. Sometimes, like today, I think she loves him, and is afraid of what that means for both of them. Adultery was a mortal sin in the eyes of the church, and often a dangerous one. But most of the time I am convinced that his amour is completely unrequited, that she is so worried about her husband that she doesn't know he exists. The pure, unattainable lady was the ideal of courtly romances. But it's clear he doesn't know whether or not she loves him either. His rescuing me in the wood and his story of the renegades was only an attempt to impress her, which would have been much more impressive if there had been 20 renegades, all armed with swords and maces and battle axes. He would obviously do anything to win her, and Lady Hermione knows it, which is why I think he's been sent off to Courcy.
This ends side one of cassette 9. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.